We are about to begin one of the most exciting, most intriguing, and all-encompassing svarim of Tanakh, which is Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel really is the building blocks of much of later Tanakh. In order to understand a lot of later Tanakh, you need to be able to understand Shmuel and Melachim to be able to understand the dynamics later on in many of the other svarim. And that's what we're about to begin today. And just to point out just again, for those who aren't aware of how the packets work, so the new packets are here, and for those who are going to be listening online, it's actually also downloadable. So there's a table of contents. I've divided up into four sections. There's the text which is divided into two parts. And then we have the additional sources to the text, which is going to be, as we go through, the more significant points, which are perhaps nicer to see inside itself, are also attached there. Then the two eons, the two overall pictures about changeover and the two Nazirim, are going to be following. And lastly, of course, there's a map just to put things in context. A new highlight of this packet, which has not been up till recently, there's always new highlights, is on page 5. What I did was I put the key for fonts. So every different stage of that we're going to be doing is in a different font. The psukim are going to be in the upper font, the middle font is going to be Chazal, and then the lower one is Mefarshim, so you get a sense again which particular time frame we're in as we're learning through this. So, without much further ado, as we realized, it was very clear to us, as we finished Sefer Shoftim, that Shoftim didn't end randomly. There were two stories, or rather perhaps even two and a half, three stories at the end of Shoftim, which were not dated. We are given those stories, the story Pesel Micha and Pelegish Begivah, and the follow-up of both of those stories, but they were not dated stories. We weren't given any specifics about when they occurred in terms of the Sefer as a whole, and we realized that the Sefer was making an argument. The author of the Sefer, which Chazal identifies Shmuel HaNavi, was making a statement about Sefer Shoftim, and how it ends is supposed to be the feeling that we are left, the revulsion they were supposed to feel to that period as a whole. With the same regard, we have to realize that Sefer Shmuel, which at least the first part is identified with Shmuel himself, because Shmuel lives, I think, if I'm not mistaken, all the way to Perek Yod Ches, in Shmuel Aleph. So Shmuel is writing about this as well. And just as in Shoftim there is an argument, in Sefer Shmuel there is an argument too. Okay, so we're going to have to understand the movement between the two Svarim. That's what we're going to try to figure out, work on today, is understanding the movement between Shoftim's arguments and the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, how that differs, and what Shmuel's trying to emphasize in that changeover. And as with any Sefer in Tanakh, it's important to focus on beginnings. Always beginnings are extremely significant, whether it be the first pasuk, the first word, the first letter even. Chazal go to great lengths describing the importance, the significance, the first letter in the Torah, the first letter in the Aseres HaDibros. It is an opening, expanding system. And therefore, when we focus on Sefer Shmuel, it's important to focus on just the first few words, just the first few sentences to appreciate, is this or how is this different to Sefer Shoftim, which we've just come out of. So without much further ado, I'd like to focus on, just without going any further, for the first three psukim of Sefer Shmuel, and from that build off. So starting on page 1, we are told the following. This is blank, fresh slate, no preconceived notions yet. We're told, Vayhi ish echad min harmatayim. There is a person, one man, from Ramatayim, Tzofim. Sounds like it's the name of a place. Okay, that's all given as translation. Mehar Ephraim, from the mountains of Ephraim. Ushmo Elkanah ben Yerocham ben Elihu ben Betovchu ben Tzuf ben Ephrati. We're told about his lineage, and he's also denoted as a Ephrati, which was seen most recently in Sefer Rus, in Megillas Rus, as Ephrati, not only necessarily with the connotation of being from Ephrat, but also maybe a delineation of nobility. Okay, so we're told about this person. We're given his lineage. Fantastic. V'losh shen Hashem. He has two wives. Shema chas chana, uchana, v'shem Hashem is Penina. So he has two wives. We're told their names. V'ahi l'fenina yiladim, u'lechana ein yiladim. So Penina has children. Chana has no children. V'aloha ish ahu me'iram yamim yamima. And this man would ascend from day to from time to time. We're going to have to work on that time frame as we delve in further. L'ishtachavos v'lisboach la'Hashem tzvakot b'Shiloh. What would he do? From time to time, he would ascend to Shiloh. Shiloh was the place of the Mishkan, right? So important to realize we're coming off a 369-year period of Shoftim, during which the Mishkan was in its abode in Shiloh, right? It's an extremely long time, just to appreciate, you know, although although Shoftim seems to be as a remarkably short sefer in connection with Shmuel and Melachim, but bear in mind, it's almost the same amount of time period the Beis HaMikdash stood, was this Mishkan in Shiloh. So he's ascending to sacrifice to Hashem Tzvakot, to the God of the legions. One of the first times this word is used, we're going to have to understand why Hashem is described as such. V'sham shnei v'nei Eli chavnil pinchas kohanim l'Hashem. And there were the two children of Eli, who was the Kohen Gadol, Chofni and Pinchas. And it's a funny way of describing that we sort of realize that Eli happens to be the Kohen Gadol by the fact that he's got two children. It's almost like assuming that we already know who Eli is. We're going to come back in, when we just do this in more depth next week to understand these specifics. There's already a lot of questions. That Beers and May, already in the first few psukim, we're told a few details. We get background. We know who he is. We know about his family. And we know where he goes. That's what we're told. Introduction to the person, family, and where he goes. That's what we're told. What does this say about Shmuel as a whole? Sefer Shmuel as a whole. Is there something significant and important about this as a whole? On this, there is a particular midrash which is not found anywhere near Sefer Shmuel, but it's called Agadas Bereshis, found on page 7, which makes the following observation. And this observation is going to be key to understanding the difference in the flow from the end of Pilegesh Begiva to where we stand right now. This is the very bottom of page 7 in source 1, which is Agadas Bereshis. And this last perek in perek Nun, which is the 50th perek, deals with Nevi'im and starts by talking about Shmuel, interestingly enough. It says the following, Vahi ish echad min haramatayim. There's one person from Ramah, which is what we described. Keshakadosh baruch hu ro'e l'dor sheyirsha. When Hashem sees that there's a generation which sins, there's a generation which is misled in their beliefs, who chozer umavakesh afilu tzadik echad sheyisle b'shvilo. God seeks out at least one person, one righteous person that Hashem can depend or save that generation based on. V'chein at motze b'Yerushalayim sh'Yerusha'im. In a particular era, in the later era, we know that there were many evildoers in the city of Jerusalem. U'bikesh mihem afilu tzadik echad sheyisle lahem b'shvilo. God sought out at least one righteous person to depend or save the city based on him. Shneemar shotatu b'chatzerot b'chutzad Yerushalayim v'chuloi im tzimtzu ish. In Yirmiyahu, Hashem is, so to speak, searching throughout the city, looking. Maybe there's one person. Maybe there's one person who can be the merit of the city. And why so? Shatzadik ma'amid es ha'olam al yasodo. That the righteous person is going to take a brunt, is going to take a lion's share in terms of sustaining a generation which may not necessarily merit as such. So God, in general, this is the methodology in general. God will search out or try to find a particular person who's going to be the basis, the foundation stone, even in a place where that's not necessarily overtly justified. And now we return to Sefer Shmuel. Notice that the word that's going to be important over here is echad, ish echad. Continues this medrash. Kevon shechatu b'mei Micha. Since Israel sinned in the times of Micha, to recap, the end of Sefer Shoftim ends with two stories. The Pesel Micha, the shrine of Micha, which we discussed at the beginning of the year, which is where there was a particular individual set up a shrine in his own basement, and then it was adopted by the tribe of Dan later on. And later on, Pilegesh Begiva, which was the terrible rape and then civil war ensuing against Binyamin. Those two stories. So came Shechatu b'mei Micha. When Israel sinned in the days of Micha, hayomakatrin letzalmo shel Micha, they were bringing incense offerings to the graven image of Micha in his house. Vayah ha'ashan shel Shila ole min hazvachim shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Vayashan salmo shel Micha ole mehar Ephraim mibeis Micha. U'misarvin ka'achas. We discussed this before, but what would happen is you'd have the smoke of both the incense of Shiloh, of the Mishkan, also to be found within spitting distance of Shiloh, and Pesel Micha, and the smoke of Pesel Micha interweaving themselves as they ascended to heaven. This image of Hashem looking down and seeing the shrine, the Avodah Zarah, and Shiloh intermingling together. That's how Hashem looked onto the end of Shoftim, looked onto this generation. Sheneemar, as it says, the last three lines, Allah Hashem ba'apa ve'esh mipiv tochal gechalim ba'arom mimenu. So that Hashem, the smoke ascends in his anger, and this fire in his mouth like burn like coals. Quoting a pasuk in Tehillim. Kivyachol chozer u'mavakesh afilu tzadik echad. In this context, God searches out, is there somebody, is there a card-carrying member that I can find to justify the continuation of this generation? Kedei shelo yapoch es olam, to not to destroy the world. Shenemar asher od bakasha nafshi v'lo matzasi, I'm searching but I haven't found. V'arakach, after these events, matza le'elkana adam echad, v'hi ish echad. And therefore, Shmuel starts with the words, v'hi ish echad. There was one man. One man meaning what? In the context of everything that was going on up till now. We've seen now a generation which has set up first a personal, now a national shrine. We see civil war, we see debauchery. And what do we see? Vayish Echad. And there's one man. And there's one man, meaning one man in the context of that. Shmuel starts off where there's a spark of hope. Something's going to change. There's somebody who does, somebody is the knight in shining armor to the context and the darkness of Sefer Shoftim. That's what this midrash is identifying. What we like to do, what we should question, what we need to really analyze fully, is where does the midrash get this? Meaning, is there something particular about Elkanah's actions that justifies this? Is there something particular about what he does, or something else we know about him that justifies the comment that this is not just one man, but it's one man in the context of the chaos that occurred previously? That's going to be our mission today, is try to understand how this midrash makes absolute sense in terms of the context of the beginning and the end of these two svarim. Yes, Leah?
Well, just the fact that he goes to Shiloh and not to Pesel Micha shows us
great
that he has some direction. And,
great.
And the fact that he's an Ephrati gives him more potential.
Great, so we know he's Ephrati, but that's not going to, you're right. That itself, I don't think by itself will justify it. But let's start with the first point that you raised. And this is a point we need to consider in general.
Can I just mention a third point?
Sure.
Is there any significance to the, can Ramatayim and Sofim, is there any, are those more, can be used as adjectives and not just places? Is it significant that he's from Ephraim?
So he's actually from he's actually a Levi, we're going to see in a few minutes, but he lives in Har Ephraim. We're going to deal with the details next week if Tzofim means Nevi'im or the place where he lives. So there is context in terms of his background, but I'd like to focus just this moment on your first point, which I think is very significant, Esther.
Also the consistency.
Okay, so there's consistency as well. Fantastic. So we see, let's pull those 2 points out just to recap right now. What Leah suggested is that first of all we see him ascending to Shiloh, to the Mishkan in Shiloh, as opposed to Pesel Micha. So really that sets up a contrast. What Esther's saying is that it's not just a once-off inspirational trip, it's the consistency of these trips. So let's try to analyze this a little further. The word Shiloh is never mentioned in Sefer Shoftim as a destination. Let's put the facts on the table. The entire Sefer Shoftim, which is the predominant, the significant time through which the Mishkan is in Shiloh is never mentioned as a destination. Isn't that interesting? But it is mentioned as a destination in the first 3 Psukim in Sefer Shmuel. By the way, we're about to get to the point where the Mishkan is about to be destroyed. The Mishkan doesn't last very long in Sefer Shmuel. Very early on in the life of Shmuel, the Mishkan will be destroyed. It's interesting that the entire Sefer Shoftim, which is the place in which the Mishkan is significant, it's sidelined. And suddenly at the beginning of the Sefer, it's highlighted. Point number one, yes.
Shiloh is, besides being a destination, it's also a destiny. The phrase, Akira Bo Shiloh, that it refers to future events and not just that temporary status.
Correct. So Shiloh represents something much more than itself as well, as mentioned in the Brachos of Yaakov. That's absolutely true, which perhaps accentuates the fact that its omission in Sefer Shoftim as a destination is so significant. Yes.
Now, isn't everybody supposed to be going up to the Mishkan on the three
great
festivals? So it is the underlying thing that people, because it says that he did from year to year, that nobody else is.
Great. Fantastic point. So let's see what Shelley just said inside. Is in source 2 over here, where we're trying to describe, we actually tangentially touched on this Gemara recently. I'm going to leave it up to you to remember when. This Gemara in Bava Basra is trying to identify when the figure of Eov lived. When did Eov actually live? Because did he live in a particular generation? And the Gemara makes one suggestion saying, Eov bimei Shvat HaShoftim Haya. This is source 2 on page 8. That Eov lived in the times of Shvat HaShoftim, the times of the judges. Sheneemar, Hein atem kulchem chazisem, Belomoze hevel ta'avolu. That you have all seen, why do you create hevel? Why do you create desolation, meaninglessness? Ezedor, shekulo hevel, have you ameshoftim? What generation can be identified as being empty, as being insignificant spiritually? Is the day of Shvat HaShoftim. Why is Shoftim identified as such? To take it further, the Gemara in Yerushalmi says the following, Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta, this is in source 3, Omar, Rabbi Yochanan, the son of Turta, said, Motzanu shilei charva shila. The Mishkan in Shila was only destroyed, shila shehayum vazim es hamo'adas, v'machalim es hakodshim. That they were, this is to translate carefully, they were disgracing the holidays, the festivals, and they were desanctifying the kodshim, the holy sacrifices. And as the explanations, the Korban HaEdah on this Yerushalmi explain, you know what this means? This means exactly as Shelley just pointed out, that what? That although you would have expected everybody to be going up to Shiloh, nobody was going up to Shiloh at this point in time. Very few individuals were actually going there, which is why, after this long extended time of nobody, of people effectively ignoring Shiloh, this is why the destruction comes over here at this point in time, at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. A very terrible reality that we're referring to over here, which is perhaps reflected in the text itself, which is why Shiloh is not mentioned. Shiloh is not mentioned as a destination in Shoftim whatsoever. As the Yerushalmi, just to appreciate this, I know that Tim mentioned this recently. When you look at a medrash, when you look at an idea in Chazal, where's it coming from? Where's the significance? Where's this Yerushalmi based on? It's clearly based on the mission, the overall. We're going to get to the exception in a moment. The overall mission of Shiloh in the entire Sefer Shoftim, only to be mentioned at the very last dying moments at the beginning of Shoftim. And that's what the Yerushalmi is mentioning. So in fact, they weren't involved in this service. But let's take it even deeper. If we're to understand that Sefer Shoftim is making an argument, that Shmuel in writing Sefer Shoftim is making an argument in the last five prokem, which is what we did more recently, that there's something wrong going on in Sefer Shoftim. There was a refrain. There was a particular line which appeared, reappeared, and reappeared again and again, describing the time of Shoftim. And that line was, right? That line was, Ish hayabayamim ahein, ein melech v'Yisrael. At the time of Shoftim, there was no king. Ish hayashar beinav yaaseh. Everybody would do that which was straight, that which was fitting in their eyes. That's the era of Shoftim. You think about this idea, or it's this vision of vigilantes in a certain sense. Which is why it's interesting that Shoftim ends off with the Lashavet being a vigilante to a certain degree. Shimshon. And then having these two stories of anarchy. We have an entire era of chaos. Okay, now let's deepen that. Yes, yeah.
Is Melech referred to a flesh and blood king or to Hashem?
Well, that's an interesting point. Most of the Mepharshim assume that it either means a shofet or a king himself. But you're right, it is reflective of the general situation as in terms of God in society. But now, let's reflect on this. These words, Isha Yashav Einav Yaaseh, are actually borrowed words. This is very interesting. The Torah uses the same words in reflecting on a particular point. Let's take a look at that together. In Source 6, this is a three psukim, or four psukim discussion about. Let's take a look. In Source 6, Ki imal amakom ashiyuchar Hashem lokeichem mikol shivteichem losum es shemoy sham. That rather you should go to the place that God decides to put His name there, or to rest His name there. L'shichnoi sidrushu uvasa sham, and you should search out to come to that place. Va'vesem sham aloisechem v'zivchechem es masroisechem. You shall bring all your sacrifices. V'shumas yedchem and the tithes of your hand v'nidreichem and your vows v'nidvoisechem and your this is a particular vow uvachoros v'karchem v'tzonachem. And your firstborns of your cattle and your sheep, v'achaltem sham lifnei Hashem Elokeichem, and you'll eat there in front of God, u'smachtem b'chol mishlach yedchem, and you will rejoice with that which God gave you, atem uvateichem, you, your houses, asher berachecha Hashem Elokeicha, that which God blessed you with. Lo sa'asun, but you should not do, k'chol asher anachnu asim po, as we do here being, Where's Moshe talking? In the Midbar. So don't do as we do here in the Midbar. Ish hakol hayashar beinav. Each person as they see fit. Interesting. Could there be a parallel between these words? Shoftim ends with En melech b'Yisrael ish hayashar beinav yaseh. Is there potentially a parallel to the description here of what's going on in the Midbar? Now the Midbar seemed like a pretty good situation, right? On the whole, you wouldn't describe that as a generation of anarchy. So what about the desert was Ish HaYashar Be'enav Yaaseh? And it's all about context. Because what are we talking about here? What are these few psukim talking about? What is the topic? What is Hashem trying to get Israel to do? To unite where? Specifically, L'shichna Sidrushu V'asa Shama, to the place that God will rest His name, to do what? To bring sacrifices. Don't do here like what you do today. What was allowed during the time of the Midbar was an ordinance called Bamot. A Bama is what we call a back garden altar, where every person had the ability to be able to sacrifice in their own back garden. Whatever they wanted, they could set up a seven altar. Lo sasun king. Don't do the kachol asher anachnu asim po hayom. Ish hayashar be'enav yaaseh. Don't do as we've done up to now. This is what the Gemara in Zvachim identifies. This is in Source 7. Tana Rabbanan, our rabbis teach, kol nider v'nidev hayakarev abama. Any person who made a general or specific vow would be able to bring it up on his own altar. She'ein nider v'nidev en karev abama. But if a person did not, the sacrifices which are not vows could not be brought up on an altar. Mincha v'nizirus kreven b'bama, and meal offerings and how we translate the nazir again, the korban of the nazir, just for a lack of translation, kreven b'bama could be brought on the altar. Divrei Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir delineates the different things that could be brought in different places. My time at Rabbi Meir. How does Rabbi Meir know that there's some korbanos which can be brought and some korbanos which cannot be brought on personal altars? He says, "Da'amar kra," because the pasuk says what we just quoted. Lo sa'asun kochol asher anachnu asim po hayom. You should not do as we do today. Amar lohen Moshe liYisrael. Moshe is explained to Israel. Ki aliyisu aliyisu la'aretz. When you enter the land of Israel, yashrus takrivu chovos lo takrivu. You can only bring that which is called yashrus. That which you, let's translate that in a moment, but you cannot bring the obligated offerings. Minchas, nazirus, yashrus, ninu. And meal offerings and the korban of a nazir are called yashrus, that's why they could be brought. And there's many different opinions as to what the delineation between which korbanos could be brought in a back garden altar or not. But irrespective of that, what we see clear from this pasuk is that when you enter into Israel, there's now going to be a destination where you cannot sacrifice on the bamos anymore. You're no longer able to sacrifice wherever you wanted because there's going to be a central point. You'll come to that point to bring your korbanos. So now, although at the end of Shoftim, when we describe Ish Hayashav HaNav Yaseh, it is clearly referring to the anarchy of the situation of Shoftim, but perhaps there's also another harmony in that as well. There's another harmony in Tanakh which we're hearing in those words, which is not just the anarchy, the terrible debauchery of the time, but also the lack of that centrality in their religious life. Ish HaYashav HaNav Yaseh is that they are doing exactly what the Torah told them not to, is with the lack of that central place. That's why Pesel Micha could exist. That's why when they fought the war against Pelegesh Begiva, there was no consultation until the third battle with the Mishkan and Shiloh. Because that wasn't a central part of their lives. The anarchy stemmed from the lack of this leadership. The lack of this place of Leshichna Sidrashu Vasa Shama. That's perhaps what the Torah is doing with these words in saying Ish HaYashav HaNav Yaseh. Shmuel's using that theme when bringing it back. But it gets deeper. It gets even deeper over here. Because, as you will notice, into this enter Elkanah. Into this fray, into this battle, enters the person that we know as Elkanah. And with a brief description at the over here, actually, even before we get there for a moment, just if you wouldn't mind taking a look at source 8, I was somewhat remiss in mentioning that there is actually an instance in Shoftim where Shiloh is mentioned explicitly, but not as a destination. Shiloh is mentioned specifically to be undermined in Sefer Shoftim, and that is in source 8. Shoftim says, "Vayasimu lohem es pesel micha asher asa." The idol of Micha, which was made, was placed or established. Kol yemei heyos beis Elokim b'shilah. The only time that the Mishkan is mentioned is to be undermined by the fact that it has a competitor. So not only is Shoftim simply a lack of central leadership, it's undermining the very enterprise of Mishkan itself, the very enterprise of Shiloh. And that is why when we read about Elkanah, it's very significant that it is in the context of Mishkan. And listen to this extra narrative, which we're not told about in the text, about the way in which Elkanah would go about going up to Shiloh. This is in source 10, but I'm going to skip all the way to the very bottom line of the page on page 8. The very bottom line says, Davar Acher, following the period. There's another explanation. Lomo ma'ale esakol imon. Why would Elkanah bring everybody with him, his whole family? Well, what was significant about this? It says, Keshayu olim baderech velanim barachova shel ir. Listen to this narrative. As they would go up, and they would stay among, in the city streets. You can imagine that it wasn't a one-day trip. They would travel from city to city. They'd pass through the main streets. They'd probably stay somewhere in a motel overnight. And as this whole family would go up, they would have different groups, the men alone, the women alone. And they'd have different conversations. You know, the men of each town that are going to would start conversing with the men, the women with the women. Katon im katon. Everybody would ask them, "Where are you going?" Right? It's clear this is not just a picnic, right? What's happening? Where's everybody heading? So they would ask the people. V'omrim el beis ha'elokim. We're going to. What was that? It's like Noah building the table. This is an eye opener. This is Avraham as well with his inn. So there's a number of parallels you can think of in Tanakh where you see somebody doing something strange and it really captures people's interest. What would happen? So people would ask him, where are you going? And he'd say, I'm going to the house of God. Shebishilo, which is in Shiloh. Shemisham teitze Torah misham ha-mitzvot. From there, the Torah will emanate and the commandments. You know what? There's lots of space. Why don't you join us? Walk up with us, he suggests. Miyad, their eyes are full of tears. Amru lohem, na'ale imachem. Can we go up with you? Amru lohem, hin, please. Oid l'shana haba'a, chamisha batim. Another 5 houses the next year. L'shana acheres asara batim. Another year, 10 houses. Meaning he'd create this snowball effect of people joining him. L'shana acheres sirgisha kula la'alos. Slowly but surely, people more and more wanted to go up. V'ayul ha'olim ha'yamena kishishim batim. Until there was about 60 houses going up with him. U'v'derek sh'ayu ole shana zu. And therefore, intentionally, that's why he'd go up on different roads each time, because he'd have a different, there'd be a different jurisdiction that he'd hit. Elkanah not only tilted the scales in their merit after Shoftim, but he also educated them. Many people merited through his hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bochen, Libos, V'Kleyos, Amaloi, Elkanah, Atach Rata, Es Yisrael, L'Kafzchus, V'Chinachtem, V'Misos. You taught, you educated my children to the right direction, V'Zachu, Rabim, Al Yadecha. Many were enlightened because of you. Ani Otzi Mimcha, Ben, She'achre, Yisrael, L'Kafzchus. I'm going to bring out of you, you're going to be the patriarch of a man who's going to bring all of Israel to the right, onto the right side of the scale, v'chanecho samim mitzvos v'yizke rabbi me'al yadav, which is whom? Which is Shmuel. So now, just to appreciate, the first 3 psukim of Sefer Shmuel are telling you what? Are telling us all that enters a person called Elkanah, who in a place devoid of interest, in a place devoid of centrality, Elkanah is going to be the person quietly, step by step, year by year, continually is moving up back towards the forgotten destination. This is our Elkanah moving back to Shiloh, and he's going to be now laying the groundwork for the whole of Sefer Shmuel, as opposed to Shoftim. But what's fascinating about this is that is exactly what the Torah wanted when it said, when the Torah wanted us to go up to the Mishkan, that's exactly what it exacted from us. If you wouldn't mind looking at the very bottom of the page 9 in Rashi, what does it mean the Shichna Sidrusha when you shall search out finding the Mishkan? Rashi says what? Ze Mishkan Shiloh. This is in fact the Mishkan of Shiloh, and the Ramban adds in source 18, the very next source, V'tam l'shichna Sidrusha shetelchu loy me'eretz marchakim. People should be ascending from different far lands. V'tishalu ono derech beis Hashem. Where is the way to go up to the house of God? But Tamru Ishal Reu, Lechu v'Naaleil Har Hashem El Beis Elokei Yaakov. That we should all go up together. What does it mean? Tidrushu, says the Ramban. You shall seek out. It means to say that you should spend time going to make sure that you get there, and that other people are aware of that as well. That's exactly what Elkanah is doing. Elkanah is rectifying Ish Hayashar Beinav Yaaseh, which the Torah was trying to avert, which Shoftim was adopting. Do you see what's going on over here? Here's the right side of the coin of that comment in Devarim, to find the Mishkan. In fact, it's the Gemara in Marcus actually identifies that if you go to Israel today, you know, you'll see many road signs all over, and you know, usually they're translated in 3 ways: English, Arabic, Hebrew. Signs all over. In the times of the Beis Hamikdash, there were also signs. But there were specifically lots of signs for one institution. You know what that was? For cities of refuge. There were many, many signs for cities of refuge. Every turning point, every crossroads, you'd have a sign saying, this is the way to go for the city of refuge. And Gemara says there were not many signs for Jerusalem and Mishkan. Because they wanted it to be that people would have to ask. They wanted it to be that you couldn't just type in, you know, one Harabais lane and that's it. Right, you'd have to be able to go around and ask the people of the towns, do you know the best way to get there? And they say, oh, where are you going? And then, right? And that's exactly what Elkanah was doing. L'shichno sidrushu means to say that it isn't just about going there, it's about creating, it's an adventure, it's something which you're becoming part of and everybody becomes part of. That's the flip side of Isha Yashar Ben Av Yaseh. That's what Shoftim was doing, that's what Elkanah is evading, yes. Is zealous on behalf of God.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's interesting to notice that because this is the way in which he carries out the zealousness is very much quiet and grassroots, which is something interesting about that. So yes, his act of zealousness, which is going to perhaps reflect itself, this should be something to think about in his son Shmuel. In the way that Shmuel conducts himself is also a very unassuming manner. We're going to see next week how Hannah actually tries to direct her prayers towards that this specific way, which relates, because remember, that's exactly what the Tana de Velia was saying. In the merit that he is doing this, is he going to get the son Shmuel? So it's obviously going to relate in which the way he does it as well.
Well, Shmuel is pretty bad.
You're thinking of a specific instance. In general, you're thinking about the end of Agag, but in most relationships you will see the Shmuel's conduct. It had to, exactly. We will absolutely. So we will see actually in Hannah's prayer for her son next week that there's actually two layers which reflect both these notions, right? The notion of being zealous, but in a quiet way, and zealous in a much more opposing way. But I'd like to just draw this to a full circle in the following. This is a very fascinating point. A very fascinating point is the text itself sets up the ducks in a line. It really puts everything in specific focus. Let's go back for a moment into the last stories in Shoftim. I apologize for those who weren't all the way through with Shoftim. I hope this is not too much assuming all the different parts of Shoftim up till now. But just to recap, it goes Shimshon, Pesel Mecha, Pelegesh Begeva, end. Okay, those are the stories that occur at the end of Sefer Shoftim. Shimshon as the last flailing Shofet, the religious anarchy of Pesel Mecha, and the civil anarchy of Pelegesh Begeva are the last stories. Interestingly, they all start in the same way. Notice, if you wouldn't mind looking in source 12, this is referring to the story of Shimshon. Vayhi ish echad. There was one man, Mitzara miyushpachas adani yushmo manach, v'ishto akara lo yalada. There was a man from Eshtael, from Tzara, sorry, that's Eshtael's a little later on. And this one man's name was Manoach. Vayhi ish echad. Fascinating. Goes on. The next, and what's fascinating about Shimshon is already in his being a shofet, you hear the shadow of what's about to come. Notice, when he wants to marry a woman, and she's not Jewish, what does he say to his parents? He says the following in Saul 13. You know, Babala, aren't there any Jewish girls that you can marry? Do you have to marry a Philistine? And there's reasons why. We discussed last year why he had to do this. I want to marry her. She was Yashra Be'inai. You're already here as you're about to enter into Pesel Micha. As you're about to enter into Pelegesh Begeva, you already hear the words the Shofet uses because it's fit in my eyes. How does that begin? Vayhi ish echad. Next, we move into Pesel Micha, source 14. This is the beginning of Perek Yud Zayin. Vayhi ish mehar Ephraim, ushmo Michayahu. There was a man, notice not echad now. There's not echad now. Interestingly enough, echad is a denotion of something special. Manoach was special. Elkanah is special. There was a man from Har Ephraim, Shmo Michayahu. That begins the devolution, the saga of Pesel Micha. And finally, and the last story in Source 15, Perek Yotes, Vayhi bayomim ahen, umelech ein b'Yisrael, that's the refrain, there's no king in Israel, Vayhi ish Levi, gar b'yarkasay Ephraim, Vayikach lo isha pilegesh, mi beis lechem Yehuda. The husband the catalyst of the civil war, perhaps the catalyst of the whole incident of Pelegesh Begev itself by throwing his wife out, right, is Vayi Ish. And notice there's a Levi. Interestingly enough, there's an Ish Levi, as we pointed out, in both Pesel Micha and Pelegesh Begev. Ish Levi is the priest in the shrine of Micha, and there's an Ish Levi who's the husband of the Pelegesh, Vayi Ish Echad, or Ish Ish in this case. And finally, to the conclusion of these three stories, this devolution, this movement towards the bottom of the precipice, we start Sefer Shmuel with Vayhi Ish Echad. And fascinatingly enough, we know from Divrei Hayamim, although not expressly told to us in Sefer Shmuel, that from Divrei Hayamim Aleph, in source 16, when listing the descendants of Levi, in B'nai Levi Gershom Kas Merari, U'B'nai Elkanah Mosav Achimos, that among the Leviim was Elkanah himself. Here we have the third Levi. Here we have the third Levi who's now coming to rectify those three Vayehi Ish. Vayehi Ish of Shimshon, Vayehi Ish of Pesel Micha, Vayehi Ish of Pelegesh Begiva, now coming full circle with Vayehi Ish Echad. Now comes enters Elkanah. Now, this is what the Midrash is doing. This is what the Midrash is identifying when it says that he is atoning, as we saw that God is voracious, that he is coming to fix the sins of Pesel Micha. In the text itself, it highlights these four stories in terms of the way it's introduced, in terms of who it is. Three Leviim, two of them who create the greatest distraction. One of them who's about to be the glimmer of hope for future leadership. Vayhi Ish Echad, as it starts. And that's why, and this is perhaps, just to close with this, this is what the Radak identifies. The Radak identifies right here at the very beginning, this is in source 21, and this will close, is the following. Mehar Ephraim, Levi Haya. Elkanah was a Levi. How does he know that? As we saw from Divrei Hayamim. Tanakh all complements itself. This is on page 10. Levi Haya, Vayagar Ba'eretz Ephraim, and he lived in the land of Ephraim, meaning don't get confused that he is from Ephraim. He is a Levi living in Ephraim, like the priest living who was a Levi who lived in Ephraim and created Pesel Micha. Ve'efshar ki latam ze nismach ma'ase Pelegesh Begiva v'sipura ze. Maybe that's why, says the Radak, that Pelegesh Begiva was juxtaposed to the story. Elkanah told us Shmuel shegam hu Levi hoya. Elkanah was also a Levi. Vayagar b'yakar sahar Ephraim. He dwelt in the very depths of Har Ephraim. Umisibasa ba'a ra'a gedola li Yisrael. But because of the Ish Levi in Pelegesh Begiva, tremendous evil befell Israel. Umisibas zeh, and from the actions of this person, Elkanah ba'a tova gedola li Yisrael. Ushmo b'noi hechzer Yisrael derech tova. And Shmuel his son would be the one to come to bring everybody back. Just to close. This theme is expressed in Mishkan. This theme is how the Torah describes is the background connection between us and God through that central religious place, that enterprise Mishkan, which is omitted, which is negated, which is reneged upon in Sefer Shoftim, comes full circle as Elkanah, as we're told, is not just the Vayi Ish Echad to rectify, but how so? By reestablishing that central point in Israel of the Mishkan. That's what he does. He reestablishes Shiloh, thereby enabling a leader to be able to rectify all the other issues which we're about to see are about to be corrected. And with this, we stand to start the text. Now we can start to appreciate the actual psukim themselves. Yes, there are some questions.